Hey everyone, back again. Today I'm starting what will be, I think, 4 episodes on Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem. And I think this text is extremely important to understand what Israel is doing to Palestine and Palestinians right now, which might not be totally apparent to you. In fact, I think this is the book and the idea, the banality of evil. This book and this idea might be the things I've been lied about the most in the history of philosophy, in all the things I've engaged in. That is, you're often taught about the banality of evil and how, oh, anybody could have participated in the Holocaust because it was, you know, evil is just banal. But that is not, that doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of what Hannah Arendt is actually doing in this book-length exposition into her coverage of Eichmann's trial in Jerusalem, because the point for her was less about pointing to Eichmann's thoughtlessness and his banality, and it was a lot more to do with calling out the way that the Israeli regime, the Israeli government, staged this trial in Jerusalem to justify Israel's existence on Palestinian land and to erase histories of Jewish cooperation with the Nazis to send 6 million other Jews to the death camps to die. And also to erase, of course, the many other people who fell victim to Nazi violence, including Roma people and the disabled in Germany and in the surrounding countries. And I want to make that all of that extremely apparent to you, and I have to dedicate this to that lovely Israeli prof who decided to reach out to me and tell me I didn't know anything. So now I'm educating myself. I'm going to educate you all about how the Zionists in Germany, many of them very happily cooperated with the Nazis who shared their Zionist aspirations. Very important that you know about this historically. And if you're saying, oh, how can that be true? Listen and you'll find out. And everything I'm going to say, you can verify. They're just facts. Facts don't care about your feelings, Ben. Now, if you want to follow me on other platforms, links for all such things in the descriptions. If you feel like helping me out, don't. Instead, donate to one of the organizations listed below. Palestinian Children's Relief Fund is one I've donated to and keep donating to. Please, if you can, or if you have any other ones that you trust, definitely do that. Palestinians right now need so much help. So much help, and it's only going to get worse, I think, as I'm recording this. Like, just a few days ago, the Israeli regime bombed a schoolyard, killing 11 children, and the entire Western media class decided it was just going to ignore that. And I just imagine if it had been the other way around. The outcry, the horror. And that's because, to them, Palestinian lives are worthless. They're like ants to the entire Western media intelligentsia class. So if you can help, please, please do so. Now, this text, or specifically Hannah Arendt's coverage of the Eichmann trial, got her in a lot of hot water, and it happened to dovetail as well and connect to her broader anti-Zionist aspirations and beliefs. She very famously, like in one letter to her husband when she was in Jerusalem, described the deplorable conditions that Arabs were living in Jerusalem after 1948, when Israel had displaced more than almost a million people, murdered hundreds and hundreds of thousands more, just in the name of their precious state. She's also very clear in the origins of totalitarianism that it's incredibly ironic that the Jews would experience the horrors that they did in the Holocaust and then turn around and commit immeasurable horrors against Palestinians and continue to this day. It's horrendous what is being done to Palestinians in the name of, I don't know, Jewish sovereignty or the ability to have a state, all while claiming that the Palestinians have no right to a state themselves. Isn't that ironic? Weren't Jewish people the stateless people who deserve a state to protect them from the violences that states were inflicting on them? Yet, hear me say this again. I'm a rationalist. I believe in equality. I believe in equity. we should, can't we apply the same thing to Palestinians? Like, oh my God, look at the horrors that Israel is committing against them. They deserve a recognized state by the United Nations to be protected by the US. They love protecting the little guy, right? But yeah, let's jump into Eichmann in Jerusalem. I can't wait for the comments. I get such fun reviews now. It's interesting. As soon as I start to poke at Zionist lies and the Israeli regime, suddenly all of the nice little Zionists come out of the woodwork and start screaming at me. Very funny how that happens. But yeah, let's jump into this. After 5.5 minutes. Hannah Arendt's Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil, chapter 1, the house of justice. Now, this is her recounting a court trial. So she spent a lot of time describing the actual scene, where she describes the courtroom, black robes, tons of documents, you know, a court trial. Poor translations of the Hebrew proceedings into German, which was Eichmann's language. Ironically, the translation to German, it was laughable, according to Arendt. I wasn't there, you know. Given that the judges and defendants were German, like all the judges were German, all the defendants were German, or Eichmann was German, and Eichmann's lawyer, Dr. Servatius, hope I'm pronouncing that right, was German as well. Now this trial was largely illegal, which isn't to defend Eichmann. Eichmann deserved exactly what he got. There's not denying that at all. But he was kidnapped when he was in Argentina, brought to Jerusalem to stand trial for crimes that he committed in Germany, which makes no sense. He should be tried in Germany. Why then was he tried in Jerusalem? To be made an example of. The Israeli regime and the Israeli prosecution in Jerusalem wanted to put the entire weight of Nazi Germany and all of the anti-Semitism that inspired it onto Eichmann's shoulders, and to have him be the embodiment of the entire Nazi party and the entirety of the Holocaust. And it was a show trial. It was absolute. The outcome was predicted way before the trial actually took place. It was a way by which in the trial took place in the early 60s and 61, when it took place at a time when Israel was really trying to justify to the world its existence and to be like, look at all the horrors that were inflicted against the Jews, and as it did happen, and this man is to blame, and therefore we must have a state so that this never happens again. But in these proceedings, Hannah Arendt says, we never learn about why he did it or how. We don't really get into those details. In fact, they conveniently leave those details out. We also never hear about the Jewish leaders, spiritual, economic leaders, who cooperated with the Nazis to help kill 6 million other their own people. Nor do we hear about the other countries and their complicity. I can't even say, like, by law, it is illegal to identify the Polish government's role here, which obviously they didn't do, right? Because it's illegal to say. But, I mean, it's the law now. But the point is, or one of the many things, and I think one of the really important insights that Hannah Arendt gives us from the origins of totalitarianism to this text, was to identify just how widespread anti-Semitism was throughout Europe, and how it wasn't just a Nazi Germany thing. Like, Romania? Hungary? Like, I mean, there was so much anti-Semitism. France? There was so much anti-Semitism all throughout Europe. And when the Israeli regime and the prosecution in this case ignores those details, what they're doing is reducing anti-Semitism to this very specific point, and to Nazi Germany, and very specifically to Eichmann, because then they can just, you know, recount all of the horrors and have a figure to blame it on, instead of identifying how broad anti-Semitism actually was, how banal it was, to the point that even Jewish leaders would participate with the Nazis. And if this is ruffling some feathers, just wait, you're going to learn all about it. That, you know, these things go unnoticed when the entirety of anti-Semitism is put on Eichmann's shoulders, which again, he's culpable, and for absolutely everything that he did. but they also don't tell you that he occupied a relatively low position in the Nazi party. He only attained the rank of like lieutenant colonel. And so he was just made an example of as a way to almost even as a kind of tacit Holocaust denial in some kind of twisted ways, where his role was relatively small compared to others. And we're going to see as well how many other higher ranking officials, not the ones who were tried at Nuremberg, who were all hanged or hung, all hanged language. Of course, they got what was coming to them, but there were so many other people who received very lenient sentences because they couldn't be blamed to the extent that Eichmann was, just because of coincidence in a lot of cases where so much of this could come to bear on him as a way to ignore how broad anti-Semitism was all throughout Europe, which, you know, must be addressed. Or like good old Netanyahu saying that, Hitler didn't actually want to kill the Jews until some Palestinian told him about it. Like, what kind of Holocaust denial is that? Like, what? Or, that's the wrong term, like, taking away culpability. Holocaust denial. Taking away culpability from Hitler, from the Nazis. Like, it's unbelievable when it says something like that, and just how horrible what happened was. Now, the difference, or one of the differences between the Nuremberg trials and between Eichmann's trials, is that the Nuremberg trials were framed as crimes against humanity that the highest-ranking Nazis had perpetuated. And this was not satisfactory to the Israeli regime, because then they couldn't single out the force of anti-Semitism in motivating Nazi Germany. And indeed, that was the largest motivational factor. But it ignores how disabled people were also systematically eradicated, and how Roma people, how other people of color were systematically eradicated as well. Now, all of that could be ignored when they just chose Eichmann as their figure to place all of the blame on, and then make him entirely culpable for this, and to make him purely responsible for everything that happened to the Jews, while erasing all of these other victims to this as well. And I know that anti-Semitism was the driving force here. Everybody knows that. But that wasn't the only goal of Nazi Germany. Or eradicating Jewish people was not the only goal. It was the biggest goal of many other ones. So the court in Jerusalem was actually organized, it was kind of scheduled where certain people could be there at certain times. When the courtroom was open to Israelis, not just to international reporters, Hannah Arendt writes that the trial was supposed to show then what it meant to live among non-Jews, to convince them that only in Israel could a Jew be safe and live an honorable life. And it turned into a trauma, like trauma porn, this traumatizing retelling of all the Holocaust horrors. And she describes just how like unnecessary this was, because none of this was relevant to Eichmann. Like, there were these periods in Eichmann's trial when they're just talking about the horrors of the Holocaust that had nothing to do with his specific actions, which again, he's culpable for. Like, these horrors are nevertheless relevant in some measure, like in understanding the Holocaust, and they should be taught in every single school. But they weren't relevant, they weren't material to his trial. Yet, they took great strides to just recount and tell every single detail about the Holocaust as a reminder to everybody in the courtroom what exactly had happened. It seems as though the point was to remind them, all the Israelis in the room, many of whom were too young to have even lived through the Holocaust, because at this point it had been about almost 20 years, 17, 18 years, how necessary Israel is and how important Israel is for Jews to feel safe, which is like, there might even be a, like, room to acknowledge that, given the histories of Jewish persecution. But does it have to come at the expense of all Palestinian lives? Does it have to go through a media spectacle such as this, and like to even use this kind of sham trial in the way that it was conducted against Eichmann? like in all of the unnecessary details that were thrown in. Now, of course, this was also used as an opportunity by then Prime Minister, the first Prime Minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, who also took this opportunity to locate anti-Semitism among the Arab states and the Palestinians, which the trial proved to be groundless. I mean, obviously that's, and this is something that's constantly repeated, like Netanyahu's claim that it was the Palestinians that convinced Hitler to run the Holocaust, which is absolutely groundless. But by framing the Holocaust as being specific to the Nazi party, you'll learn more about that, but anti-Semitism specific to the Nazi party, what it did is it allowed the Israelis to like single out this one group as being this like ultimate evil, and to make it seem as though then therefore the only way for, you know, Jews to really be safe is if these people are held accountable and that there's this safe haven for them away from these people. It also erases the fact that broadly throughout Europe, anti-Semitism was rampant. Like, so many cases, like, you'll learn more about it as we go on here, but if you don't already know, obviously anti-Semitism was running rampant. This didn't fit Israel's narrative that actually tried to cozy up very much with many of the European states, because then they would have to actually hold them all accountable as well. But it goes to show, reveals that perhaps less of Israel's point, at least in the prosecution's point, was to actually prove how widespread anti-Semitism was throughout Europe, because then they would be alienating themselves from people who were funding them and assisting them in their capture of Palestinian land. And I think that all of this, I'm just recounting what Arendt says. All of this is clear when we see this kind of suspicious lack of attention given to Eichmann's comrades who were just freely living in Europe at the time and who were no less guilty. The trial seemed about less than bringing these people justice, like Otto Bradfisch, Franz Nova, Hermann Krumme, and many others. And it would seem more about justifying Israel's existence among a sea of apparently like anti-Semitic Arab states. Because if their real concern was about, you know, anti-Semitism and the Nazi party, why were they not bringing all these people in? You know, they couldn't be, anti-Semitism couldn't be attributed to them as neatly as Eichmann, but in any case, it's, I think, totally relevant. But much of this would actually come to backfire, because Eichmann's affiliations with the early Zionists would become plain to see and made very apparent in this trial, where he, among other high-ranking Nazi officials, organized with Zionists, gave them special privileges if they helped them attain their Zionist program in Palestine. And this thing about Arab states being anti-Semitic, like, this is often repeated, but the Holocaust didn't happen in Saudi Arabia or in Iran. It happened in Germany, Hungary. Well, at least there are so many Auschwitz was in Poland, like Romania. Oh my God. Like, the horrors were inflicted against Jewish people in Romania, France, Italy. Although Italy, you know, there's not so much. But in any case, it was in Europe. It was a Western European thing. It wasn't an Arabic thing, as much as Israel would like the world to believe that now. But you might be thinking, David, you're seriously downplaying, like, you know, Eichmann's culpability here. And we're going to get into that. We're going to really get into that, because I definitely don't want you to think I think that. I think that he's very culpable and should be held accountable. Absolutely. But he was not the only one on trial. Definitely anti-Semitism was on trial. And ironically, in the way that the prosecution framed... in the way that the prosecution framed Eichmann's roles, it was like he was just a hapless victim to German anti-Semitism. And he was just this executioner. Made sure it happened the way that this nebulous creature called anti-Semitism, nevertheless material and real creature, but one that was like within this trial very suspiciously confined to the Nazi party. Anti-Semitism like was then put on trial, but a very specific brand of it, where anti-Semitism's trial was not without its own defense. But who defended it? Who was kind of defending anti-Semitism? We find it from the prosecution, from the Attorney General himself, who cites Ezekiel to say that when the Lord passed by thee and saw thee polluted in thine own blood, he said unto thee, in thy blood live. And Arendt reads this as an optimistic view of anti-Semitism's horrors in permitting the state of Israel to be formed and to rise from the desecrated corpses of 6 million Jews, which at the time she was writing 5 million, because I guess the number wasn't quite as accurate. And this was a common thing where there was kind of this weird value found in the Holocaust. Hence I loosely use the term Holocaust denial, and we should talk about the conspiracy theories, like Holocaust denial conspiracy theories, because they are obviously really horrendous. I've been meaning to watch it. It's called Dr. Death. I think it's an Errol Morris film about the Holocaust denier guy who would build designed like the electric chair. I think that's who it was. I'm interested in that. Obviously, I study conspiracy theories and know very much about Holocaust deniers and like how they contribute to the broader discourse of anti-Semitism. But in any case, when Arendt is pointing to this passage, which I think is really like, what a haunting thing to say at a court trial where you are prosecuting the person who is apparently solely, like, of all the people alive at that moment, solely responsible for the Holocaust. You say, oh, in thy blood live, as though there was like anything to be gained from the Holocaust, as though it was worth it, or there was something good to come out of it, and that good thing being the state of Israel. Like, what? Like, that blows my mind. And it blew Arendt's mind. She's like, my friends and my family were murdered, and you're saying that it was a good thing, or there was something to be gained from it? Like, what a disgusting thing to say. And that puts us here into chapter 2, the accused. Now, Eichmann pleaded not guilty in the sense of indictment, as though to say that because he never directly murdered anyone, because he didn't, like, stab anyone to death or, you know, run the gas chambers, he was mostly responsible for deporting Jews and moving them around. That was primarily his job. With some exceptions, he also worked with Jewish leaders to help him do this. Don't forget that. Eichmann pleaded not guilty in the sense of indictment, as though to say that because he never directly murdered anyone, he was not culpable. Now, Arendt notes that no one confirmed that this was indeed his stance. Like, no one asked, was like, well, what do you mean by that? Not guilty in the sense of indictment. She's just speculating this. And this was, if this was indeed his stance, and they just assumed that he saw himself as guilty before God and not the state. So Arendt's reading is that, like, he viewed himself as not culpable because he didn't actually do killing. Doesn't mean he's not culpable, just not in the sense of the way the trial was prosecuting him. But people in the court seem to just say that he was only culpable in the eyes of God and not the state, because he was just following orders, which will become part of that banality piece. So what evidence was there against him? What evidence was there against Eichmann? The prosecutor spent a significant amount of time trying to connect a direct order from Eichmann to the slaughter of hundreds of Jewish and Roma men in Yugoslavia, among other things. Like, there were many other pieces of evidence. This is just one of them. And the evidence, though, there was a dribbled note by a radio operator from Eichmann to start shooting. That was the claim. Arendt doesn't defend Eichmann, like, don't get it wrong, but points out the strange decision to find him guilty in this case when he was responsible for so many more deaths. Like, this was kind of the focus, or the crucial point here. But to do so, that is to actually go after him for all of the other deaths that he was responsible for by helping to move Jews, by organizing how Jews would actually be deported from France, from Hungary, from Romania. By doing all that, he resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands by his command alone, perhaps even into the millions of Jews. But to do so would mean confronting how ubiquitous anti-Semitism actually was, and how He was a symptom and not a cause. He just was like a mouthpiece and an executor. He executed anti-Semitism and wasn't like the creator, this evil, ultimate evil being that the Israeli regime wanted desperately to frame him as, to justify just like the absolute horror that was him and him alone, to justify this entire trial that could then be used to justify to the international community the need for Israel as a safe haven for Jews. And he was even recorded saying, or he's even reported saying, he would have killed his own father if he was ordered to. So, and this is why Hannah Arendt got in so much, or one of the reasons Hannah Arendt got so much in trouble for this, she was like, he wasn't that anti-Semitic. And there's going to be lots of evidence, I'll tell you why. He was just following orders. And so you hear that, and this is how we're often taught about this thing, the banality of evil, that, oh, any one of us could do it. But her point is not to just be like, oh, anyone can, you know, commit atrocities. Her point is very specific. I mean, that is part of her point. But really, the overall intent of her phrase is to identify that Eichmann was not this ultimate evil, anti-Semitic, Jew-hating Nazi. Like, his actions resulted, murdered, perhaps in him alone, upwards of 1 million Jews. Like, there's no denying that. But that was not his intent. In fact, he was horrified when he learned that his actions were leading to the deaths of so many Jews. But that didn't fit with the Israeli regime. They needed him to be a maniacal, Jew-hating, anti-Semitic murderer, and not just a normal person. In fact, he recounts how he was indebted to Jewish family members for getting him jobs when no one else would, as a school dropout, and how he was working with and tried to actually save thousands of Jews in many instances. The point is to say that a genocide can be perpetuated by normal people who harbor no negative feelings towards their victims. But that's not, the Israeli regime had to make it purely about his being this evil, single-handed, like, anti-Semitic Jew hater in order to justify this trial. Arendt even recounts that Eichmann's entrance into the Nazi party happened nearly spontaneously and coincidentally without knowledge of their plans at all. He just kind of stumbled into this position. He just wanted an escape from his traveling salesman job at the Bavarian Vacuum Oil Company. Like, he was a school dropout. He sucked in the military. He was just traveling, like, he was selling vacuums. Like, and then all of a sudden he just wound up in this position and was just following orders. He was a thoughtless, like, he was unintelligent, thoughtless, no creativity, or like, he couldn't have devised anything, according to Arendt. Now, and then eventually, after the doing a stint with the vacuum company, he joined the military, which he despised, and took the first chance to leave by joining the higher ranks of the SS, and this was in the mid-30s, in 1934. Which was largely a coincidence that he was able to earn that spot. And that puts us into chapter 3, An Expert on the Jewish Question. And when he first started work in the SS, he was assigned to the SD, that is a cultural intelligence branch, where he was responsible for one of the other targets of the Nazis, many other ones. They also liquidated communists, Catholics, and Freemasons. But he was actually first tasked with the job of learning about Freemasons to construct a museum consecrating their crimes. That is, they were clumped with Jews, communists, and Catholics. And the Nazis had this very haunting practice of creating museums of the people that they were, like, committing violence against. Like, really horrendous stuff. It's haunting. Freaks me out. Now, like I've said many times, anti-Semitism was rampant throughout Europe long before the Nazis took power. I mean, they were being stripped of legal protections, they were denied access to higher learning, and German women were forbidden to work in Jewish homes after a certain age, like just in Germany. And this is the world that Eichmann grew up in. And these were some of the first Nazi efforts at a political solution to the Jewish question before the final solution. And the Jewish question extended far earlier than the Nazis. Like, and this, like, the violence that has been inflicted against Jewish people cannot be ignored historically. Like, it's horrendous where they've been seen and painted as this evil, haunting figure, almost like a parasite within Europe for millennia. And the Jewish question has long predated the Nazis, where Jews were depicted and people would actually ponder, like, what should be done about these evil people? Like, it's horrible when most of them are just these absolutely poor people living in, like, abject poverty in these horrible conditions because of years of prosecution that, you know, they had no power or money or anything, and they were victimized to this extent. And then it would culminate into the Holocaust. Now, it was when, around this time, in the mid-30s, when Eichmann entered the ranks of the SS, that he encountered Theodor Herzl's justification for Zionism. Theodor Herzl being kind of the father of Zionism. The guy was like, the Jews need a place to be safe in Madagascar or Argentina or in their Holy Land. And there were also ideas about even Canada or other parts of the world that had wide swaths of land that weren't occupied, apparently. I mean, they didn't give a shit about that. They would have been willing to go anywhere and just kill anyone who's on their land. But, you know, he didn't care about that. Didn't care. They were... Go check out my episodes on the question of Palestine if you're interested. But they were really... It did not matter who was in their way. And Eichmann liked Zionism. He thought it was a great solution to the Jewish question because he didn't want to kill anyone. That was not even on the radar, even among the higher members of the SS. Like, there may have been a few people who were in the mid-30s. This wasn't on, I don't think it was on anyone's radar. The final solution, which I'm going to break it down for you as we go on here, the final solution would only come into play much later, even though, like, Jews were being killed indiscriminately much earlier than this all throughout Europe. Like, it was horrendous. But Eichmann wanted the Jewish question to be solved in a peaceful way. He wanted the Jewish question to be solved by giving Jews what they wanted, that is, Zionist Jews, what they wanted, in their claiming some land somewhere. Like, in this case, it happened to be Palestine. And Eichmann even collaborated with the Hungarian Zionist Rudolf Kastner to siphon some Jews destined for Auschwitz to Palestine. And Eichmann applauded Kastner for sacrificing his own people for the Zionist dream, for the Zionist idea. And there's a passage I want to read from much later in the book, right towards the end, when he says that in the case of Kastner, it also became clear that the Zionist functionaries in Hungary had received greater privileges than the usual temporary immunity to arrest and deportation granted to the members of the Jewish Council. The Jewish Council was a group of high-ranking Jews that helped the Nazis actually organize Jewish people to tell the Nazis where the Jews were, where what places they occupied, and to help deport them to the death camps. And she continues here. The Zionists were free to come and go practically as they pleased. They were exempt from wearing the yellow star. They received permits to visit concentration camps in Hungary. And somewhat later, Dr. Kastner, the original founder of the Relief and Rescue Committee, could even travel about Nazi Germany without any identification papers showing that he was a Jew, which is horrendous. And there were many others, and we're going to get more into the Jewish Council of Elders as we go on, but these were groups of people that, like, one of Arendt's, the things that haunt Arendt throughout this book is, like, why was it so easy for the Nazis to just round up Jews like this and send them to death camps? And, I mean, the immediate answer is, like, well, they had no choice. I mean, these are people who experienced millennia of prosecution, violence, disenfranchisement. It's not like they had resources to fight against the Nazis. Like, they had machine guns. Like, you can't do anything. But this think about the time, though. Like, it would have been difficult for the Nazis to know where Jews were all throughout Europe. Poland, Hungary, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Czech Republic, Austria, Poland, France, Germany. And it was because, and Arendt notes, that Jewish elders, many of whom were Zionists, cooperated and helped the Nazis actually tell them, this is where the Jews are, this is how we can clump them together, and this is how we can easily deport them. Now, Eichmann was so committed to the Zionist project that he actually found ways to expedite visa processes for Jews in Germany. And he appealed to foreign Jewish organizations to support Austrian and German Jews who had just lost their homes and money. Like, that's a strange thing for the absolute evil, Jew-hating, anti-Semitic Eichmann to do, unless he wasn't, like, this ultimate evil in the way that the trial was framing him. And I have to keep saying it because I know that there are people out there who are not going to listen to this in good faith. He deserved everything that he got, and he was absolutely culpable, but not in the exact way that the Jerusalem court made it out to seem. Like, he was participating with Jewish Zionists to achieve their goals because it was an I scratch my back, or you scratch my back, I scratch yours type thing, where they were helping each other to attain their ends, their hopes. And of course, this isn't to erase his anti-Semitism. Like, absolutely not. He, at best, he was, like, indifferent, but that he wasn't. He saw them as being, like, absolutely a problem that had to be solved, but not through violence. That was not something that he advocated. Moreover, he openly gloated about his role in the final solution, though, even if he embellished the details, which shouldn't be ignored. This is partly how he got caught in Argentina, as he was, like, talking about it openly, and they were like, well, let's go kidnap him. Like, he's over there. He'll be the perfect person to single out for this. Now, he took responsibility for Nazi plans that he had nothing to do with, and this came to light during the trial. Like, he was a low-ranking person that had not a whole lot of power relative to the actual architects of the Holocaust. For example, the plan to send Jews to Madagascar after the war, which it turns out, was conceived by Lowenhartz, not by Eichmann. And then there's another case of a guy named Storfer, whom Eichmann tried to protect, the guy was hardly a Zionist, but he cooperated with Eichmann to get 3,500 Jews out of Europe, to actually divert them away from being sent to death camps, so that they wouldn't, because Eichmann was a little bit suspicious about what was going on, because a lot of this was kept from him. He didn't know what was going on there. And the thoughtlessness element is really important to Arendt, where she's like, Eichmann couldn't string a coherent sentence together, let alone be the sole architect of the Holocaust. She just emphasizes over and over and over again his weaknesses in his own language, relying on cliches and poorly recalled sentences. His inability to speak mirrored his inability to think. He was just a normal person, like an unthinking normal person for Arendt. He could only parrot his culture and then his role with the Nazis, dramatizing it on full display for 10 years afterwards. So he wasn't, for Arendt, a monster. He was a clown. He was just someone, in her words, a clown, which is my thing. I love calling people clowns. He was just a clown. He was somebody who parroted culture, made a mockery of it, didn't actually know how to create anything or to think through a problem. He just acted according to whatever's being handed down to him, which the Israeli court was not interested in. And this is why Hannah Arendt got into so much trouble with the Jewish community, especially the Zionist Jewish community, because she was trying to show that Eichmann was not this ultimate evil. He was just a regular person. And that's, like, I mean, it's also in our interest in more broadly confronting anti-Semitism and recognizing, you know, how banal it is. But that also, he wasn't guided purely by anti-Semitic hatred. He was just following these orders, which is obviously horrifying. But that flies in the face, then, of the Israeli court's efforts to try and make this purely a case of anti-Semitic Jewish hatred. Like, that was not the case for Arendt. And yeah, we'll close that off here, and we'll pick up next time with chapter 4. I didn't mention what chapters, whatever. This was chapters 1 to 3. Next, we're going to pick up with chapter 4, and we'll go from chapter 4 to chapter 7, and then that'll wrap up. episode 2. But yeah, if there's anything I got wrong, I'd love to hear about it. Anything I excluded, I'd love to hear about it. Obviously, this is a very contentious topic, but I think it's super important because this is a text I've been lied to about for all my education. I'd never actually read it before now. And we have to thank our lovely Israeli prof who decided to reach out to me to make this my mission to really hyper-focus on this topic now. So yeah, thanks, Israeli prof. I know you're listening. Just pat yourself on the back. I hope I can help teach people about the history of Zionism and their attachment, actually, to the Nazi Party in the Nazi Party's early days. Very interesting history. Very interesting. But yeah, on that note, take care.